On Tech News Today, Aereo and the future of TV go to the Supreme Court. State sales tax hammers Amazon sales. Netflix and Comcast go to war, a war of words. Lytro unveils a new camera that actually looks like a camera. And AT&T is getting into the internet TV business. All that and more coming up next.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Tuesday, April 22nd, 2014. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free two-week trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TNT. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Mike Elgin.
And I'm Jason Howell.
Tech News Today explores the big stories of the day in conversation with some of the world's best journalists. Our guest co-anchor today is Peter Rojas. Peter is VP of Strategy for the AOL Brand Group and the creator of Gizmodo and Gadget, Joystick, Record Label, and Gadget. Welcome, Peter.
Oh, there we go. Sorry, I had you muted. There we go.
Welcome to Tech News Today.
Thanks for unmuting me.
You may talk.
If I blow it, he's going to mute me too, so
that's right.
You're not alone.
I have the power.
So what is a VP of strategy for the AOL Brand Group do? You strategize all day?
Yeah, I play a lot of Stratego, actually. So what I do is I work with the CEO of the brand group, Susan Line, and the head of product here, and kind of help figure out like what kind of new stuff we want to do, what new platforms we should be building, on or distributing our content or sites on, stuff like that. And so it's a mix of a lot of different stuff, but a lot more behind the scenes than what I was doing before.
Yeah, and probably
just kind of a nice change of pace.
Yeah, very different from launching very popular websites, I imagine.
Yeah, it's I had a lot of fun doing that, and I obviously love blogging and still do it from time to time. Yeah. But it's good to kind of focus on for kind of being a little bit more in the background and focusing on building new products and helping the sites here like with their problems and figuring out what they want to do.
Well, I'm a big fan of you and your career, and I'm glad you're here on Tech News Today.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
All right, let's jump into the news. The future of television is being decided by the Supreme Court starting today. Aereo defends itself in a lawsuit by ABC, CBS, NBC, and other major broadcasters. Aereo says they're simply renting dime-sized TV antennas. Broadcasters say they're stealing TV shows and selling them without paying the content creators or owners. If Aereo wins the case, mainstream broadcasters could move to cable, and a new live streaming TV business model would be legitimized. If Aereo loses the case, they'll go out of business immediately. Jordan Crook is a writer and reporter for TechCrunch and posted an exclusive interview this morning with Aereo CEO Chet Kanojia. Welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, the existence of Chet Kanojia's company will be determined by the outcome of this case. How confident is he that Aereo will prevail?
Well, Chet is very hesitant to answer that question. And to be quite clear, Aereo may not go out of business even if they lose this case. It all depends on kind of the scope of the decision that's made by the Supreme Court justices. They may decide the relief that was being sought for by ABC and these other companies was maybe that, users couldn't record the television shows while they were on the air or while they were live. But could watch them after the fact. So that's a potential outcome as well. In terms of his confidence, I think he believes in his merits. The company itself was built to withstand and to be within the law. And so I think that he is very confident going in, but you never know what could happen. I mean, these are people trying to understand something that's very complicated and nuanced and is up for, debate, I guess, in a lot of ways.
Now, this is a rare kind of case because it's really unclear what the outcome will be, and it really could go either way. Essentially, to oversimplify the contest here, Aereo says that they rent little antennas, and they also rent specific space on servers in their data centers to people who want to just get regular broadcast TV. In other words, it's like an antenna on your roof, except it's not on your roof. It's in their data center, and then when you download and sort of TiVo or record a show or something like that, they keep it in the cloud for you, but they don't duplicate it. In other words, if 100 people sort of record the same show, they don't just make one copy. They make 100 copies. Each person has their own specific space on their hard drives. And so they're basically saying that this is a private viewing, that they're just renting this equipment. And then the broadcasters are saying, no, this is presented as an alternative to cable. And so, you know, they need to pay us if they're going to be using this content, and that this is, in fact, a public performance, as they call it, and therefore this is an illegal use of their content. Now, you asked Chet Kanogia about what I think is an unexpected factor in this case, which is that the Assistant Attorney General and Copyright Office will be speaking today on behalf of the broadcasters and against Aereo during oral arguments. Does he find it unfair that the U.S. government is actually taking sides in this case?
I don't know. How unfair is it that major companies like Google and Facebook are taking Aereo's side? I think that both entities are probably equally as powerful. And so when you look at it, yes, it is slightly unexpected. And I personally think that it's a totally ridiculous move by the United States government. I think it shows a lack of maybe understanding or a forethought looking towards the future. But I don't think that he's necessarily worried about it. And I think that he trusts, you know, the Supreme Court was put in place to not necessarily have to answer to the government in that way. So I think that he is very confident in the wisdom of the judges. And I don't think that he's necessarily distracted by that appearance.
Yeah, I mean, I understand the Googles of the world taking sides in this because they have a financial interest in this. They're job and their responsibility to their shareholders to do whatever's in the interest of themselves and their customers. The government is supposed to represent the people and balance the interests of, you know, industry versus the rights and so on of the people. And there's also the historic question of who owns the airwaves and what you can do with what's broadcast over the airwaves. And so that's what makes it surprising to me that the government is getting involved in this case. They really, you know, it seems to me that it would be much more reasonable for them to just butt out and just let the Supreme Court handle it without them taking sides one way or the other. Now, Chet Kanogia focuses on the transmit clause to make the point that the outcome of this case could affect all cloud storage providers such as Google and Dropbox. What is his point there? It's an interesting take on this case, I think.
Yeah, it is, and it's very complicated, actually. So it all kind of relates back to Aereo's initial argument. And so what they're saying is that Aereo is a combination of two services. You're essentially renting an antenna instead of buying one at the hardware store, the electronics store, and putting it on your TV. So you're renting that antenna. And then the second part of the service is this cloud DVR, which is very, very similar to what you get in Dropbox or Google Drive. It's storing stuff on a server and you access it from whatever device you'd like. In the case of the transmit clause, The broadcasters are arguing that every time that a private transmission is made, so that means that if I buy a Lady Gaga song on iTunes and I put it in Google Drive, every time that happens, because that's one copy that we got from iTunes and then it became my copy, if I switch it over to Google Drive, every time that someone does that, those should be counted as aggregate transmissions, which would make that public. That is essentially what they're arguing for Aereo. And then the implication of that is that, like I said, anytime that someone loads something up in Google Drive, it should be counted as the aggregate private transmissions. And that is how you decide whether or not it's public or private, if 10,000 people are doing it or if one person is doing it. And Chet's argument is essentially that within the transmit clause in the Copyright Act, there is no indication whatsoever that these transmissions should be aggregated or re-aggregated. Once it goes private, once I own it, I have the right to do whatever I'd like with it. And it can't go from private to public. That's not really how it works. And so I think that that's kind of the argument that he's making. And a lot of the broadcasters are coming back and saying, well, Google Drive and Dropbox, they don't actually provide the content in the first place. People aren't getting content from Dropbox and then transmitting it up and down, right? And the way that Chet looks at that is he says, well, we're not actually providing the content either. Our system sits entirely dead. It's not tuned to any frequency. It's not recording anything until the user who has rented that antenna tunes to a certain channel, captures that content, and chooses to watch it at the time and place of their choosing. And so it kind of all feeds back into his original argument, I guess.
Yeah, and Peter Rojas, this to me is the most fascinating thing about this case. From the point of view of Aereo, they're simply making their equipment available and allowing users to use their services to download TV shows from the airwaves, so it's not originating with Aereo, and then store it on their equipment. And so from their perspective, they're not providing content. From the point of view of the users, users are using Aereo as an alternative to companies that do provide content. So the experience of using Aereo is very similar to using a, you know, having a cable subscription service or something like that. So like, this is really the case. What matters, the user experience or Aereo's facts about where the content is coming from?
Well, I think, I mean, this is why the law that we have governing this stuff doesn't really make as much sense in the internet age. And I think that even the you know, the Betamax ruling, which clearly makes it legal for people to record television broadcasts, I think there's the question is whether that is something that should be considered, I mean, you know, whether it should be considered a purely sort of private act, or whether it's something that could be done, that could be contracted out to a business outside the home. I actually think that the idea that it's a, that Aereo is creating a public transmission, I don't necessarily buy that. But I think that there's some haziness around the idea of, if you're taking, that it's clear that you can record, you know, public television broadcasts in your privacy of your home and use them, you know, in the privacy of your home. I think that, to me, that the question is it legal to contract that to someone outside of the home? And I, my sense is that the law probably does allow that, because the law was not written with this scenario in mind. But I think that if you're sort of showing that the shortcomings of these situations, and how it's not as easy to delineate where, you know, an activity stops being public and becomes private, or vice versa.
And again, Aereo would not consider them to be have the contractor for the recording. Like, that's not what they consider their business to be. They're not recording the content.
Sure.
The user is recording the content. I mean, that
the
granular details of it are where it becomes hazy, because it's the combination of these two businesses, of the antenna and then the recording and cloud storage. So it's like that's where things get really mucky, I think.
Yeah. I mean, clearly you are allowed to, like, if I hired you to come into my home and set up a server and an antenna and to do all those services, and I even paid you to do them for me and even paid you per month to rent that equipment, that would be allowed. I think it's this idea of, once you take it outside of the home, does it lose the aura of it being a personal private activity and becoming public activity? Not even in terms of transition, but in terms of a for personal use.
Right. Okay. I can see where you're coming on. Because, you know, there are two precedents that are at play here. It's not just Sony Betamax, because that's the right to record public broadcasts. Yeah. And then there's also Cablevision, which was from a few years ago, which is much more recent. And Cablevision was essentially arguing that if I have a DVR service and the recording, the actual content itself that I'm recording, is stored in the cloud, people were all upset about that. That seemed like it should be wrong. And Cablevision won the case. And they said, you know, as long as the user is in charge of the recording itself and in charge of the copy and decides when and how they want to watch it, then it doesn't matter if it's stored in their living room or if it's stored in a server, you know, that's owned by Cablevision. Wow. And so those two precedents are kind of what the broadcasters are looking, or maybe not the first one, but Cablevision is something they're definitely looking to overturn. And that is where all of the Dropbox, Google Drive hysteria comes into play.
Yeah, I think at least with Cablevision, though, you can't make those recordings without having paid, so to speak, for the content via your cable subscription.
But the content is free. The content that Aereo pulls in is, you are free to access it.
I know. I know. What I'm saying from the broadcasters, I'm not defending the broadcasters. I don't know whether or not they're going to win this case, but I think that they deserve to lose this case.
I agree entirely.
Yeah. But I'm saying, from their perspective, they get paid for those copies, so to speak, that are being made via via their agreements, their carriage agreements
cable
with
company.
Cablevision.
Right.
So it's very hazy, because again, there's also these issues of like you pointed out earlier around, you know, the public's right to content, which is broadcast over the public airwaves. And that's one of the conditions of your license as a broadcaster.
Mm-hmm.
Cable companies don't have to deal with.
And that's why I think that Chet makes a really great point. The broadcasters have been really adorable lately and saying, oh, we're going to pull our stuff off the air and we're going to take all of, you know, all your sports away, and like just making these ridiculous threats. And at the end of the day, it would take an incredible argument and a lot of, I'm sure, money to get the government to agree to make it work from a revenue stance. You know, those are 60 million. They claim 60 million people are using the antennas to access their content over the air for free. That's 60 million eyeballs that they lose in their advertising revenue, which makes up 90% of the money that they make on any given day or year. So that doesn't make sense. And from a policy standpoint, the government will not be okay with that. Oh, so you think that because, you know, you lost this battle, that these 60 million Americans or however many million Americans don't have access to public television that is crucial to, you know, understanding the news and other, you know, public information. So it's an uphill battle. I don't see that happening. I don't.
If they'd like
to
give up their broadcast licenses, I'm sure that somebody else would take them.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Personally, I think the world would be better off if the broadcast television system went away and we had universal internet connectivity. That would probably be a better public service than the crap that's on TV these days.
I agree.
My opinion. I also, since I'm spouting opinions here, I also do side with Aereo in this case personally, but I think they're going to lose. That's my prediction, separate from my opinion about who should lose. Now, Jordan Crook, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today and telling us about your interview with Chet Kanojia.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
All right. You can find Jordan Crook at TechCrunch.com, of course, and on Twitter at Jordan Crook. Well, in a sec, we're going to tell you what's happening with Amazon. But first, I want to tell you about Squarespace, the best place anywhere ever to build a website. And the reason is that you can build a site very easily with stunning design, highly functional and super robust and very easy to manage and maintain. Squarespace has 25 beautiful templates for you to start with, and they've recently added a logo creator tool so you can build your own logo if you have a small business. If you are selling something online, all subscription plan levels now support e-commerce, so you can accept money whether you're selling things, whether you have a nonprofit, cash wedding registry, school fund drive, whatever it is that requires you to collect money. Squarespace makes it super easy, and it's inexpensive. It starts at just $8 a month, and that includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. Squarespace is also mobile ready. A Squarespace metric app for iPhone and iPad lets you check site stats, and a blog app lets you make text updates and tap and drag images to change layouts and monitor comments on the go, which is very, very important. Hosting, of course, is included, and it's very, very robust. You pretty much can't bring I've never heard of a Squarespace site being brought down. So this is really a fantastic service, very easy to use. And in fact, I actually find it a source of entertainment just to go to squarespace.com, create a new website, and just see what happens. It's so easy to do and so enjoyable to use because the tools are so easy to use. So start a free 2-week trial with no credit card required and start building your website. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code TNT, and that'll get you 10% off and also show your support for Tech News Today. We thank Squarespace for their support of Tech News Today, and remember that a better web awaits, and it starts with your new Squarespace website. Well, a new study says that Amazon sales drop sharply in states that collect online sales tax. Matthew C. Klein is a columnist for Bloomberg View, and he joins us by telephone. Welcome, Matthew.
Thank you very much.
Now, you wrote a piece published today that asked the question, will sales taxes doom Amazon? Before we get to that question, can you tell us what the Ohio State University study, which is called the Amazon sales tax, or the Amazon tax, I believe it's called, what did they find out?
So basically what they did was they tracked spending about a quarter of a million households from the beginning of 2012 to the end of 2013. Those households had the common characteristic that each spent at least $100 on Amazon in the first half of 2012. And then what happened was that five states in the country added new taxes on essentially forced Amazon to collect sales taxes for that state: Virginia, Texas, California, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey. And what they then did was they compared how the behavior of shoppers who lived in those states changed in response to the tax relative to shoppers in the other 45 states that didn't change their tax laws. Some already taxed Amazon, or rather forced Amazon to collect sales taxes, and some didn't. And what they found was that on average, the behavior of shoppers basically cut their spending by about 9.5% on Amazon after the tax was introduced, relative to what they would have done if there had been no tax. So if Amazon sales went up overall, you have to compare them against, you know, what they would have happened, what would have happened. And they found it at a 9.5% reduction. What's really striking is that for large purchases, the effect was even bigger. So if you look at purchases of $300 or more on Amazon, those fell by about 23.8%. Which is, a huge change. And the sort of flip side of this is that the main beneficiaries were Amazon's competitors, not so much brick and mortar, but rather brick and mortar retailers that also sold things online. So, for example, people would buy things online from, say, Best Buy or Target rather than going in store, and those sales increased by about 20% on average. So you see a real substitution effect because, you know, previously they had a disadvantage against Amazon because they already had to collect sales taxes, but once that disadvantage was removed, people shifted somewhat. The other big beneficiary was the Amazon merchant group, because generally speaking, they didn't have to collect any sales taxes because they're out of state and the law changes didn't apply to them. So what you see is a bigger increase there, where for large purchases in particular, it increased by about 60%. Their sales. So in a smaller base, but people generally found if they were shopping on Amazon, they noticed that things were more expensive because of the tax, and then decided, oh, well, I can just buy from another vendor and save potentially a very large sum of money, especially for the big purchases.
Now, this point that that you make, that brick and mortar companies are not affected that much, it's really Amazon's online competitors. That's an interesting point, in part because I believe these laws were enacted precisely to protect brick and mortar businesses. It's kind of a state protectionism type of thing. Is that your understanding
right.
as well?
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting that I think it's possible if you look back at, say, the 1990s, if those laws had been enacted then, we would have actually seen things evolve very differently. But for whatever reason, whether it's a tax advantage or what have you, the internet shopping experience has evolved to the point where people just they find it more convenient in a lot of cases to shop at home in your underwear on the couch rather than having to go to a store somewhere. So, I mean, to be clear, the sales at brick and mortar stores did increase, but it was only by about 2%. So it was pretty insignificant compared to the gains that are made online. It didn't really offset. And that wasn't really where most of the money moved to and how consumers adjust their spending habits. So I think it is interesting that the goal was to sort of equalize the playing field for these big box retailers, and it didn't really happen. It did in terms of the company at the company level, but not in terms of how people actually bought things. They generally still preferred to do it online if they were doing that before.
I see. Now, Peter Rojas, now you've been following this, I know, for years. Do you think that the Amazons of the world and other online e-commerce type companies would have gotten off the ground in the first place if they had been taxed from the get-go?
Well, I think it's I think that their initial growth may have slowed. I think that been slower, but I think that as Matthew pointed out, the convenience of online shopping is so great that. Sales tax is not necessarily a massive factor for people past a certain point. I mean, I know for me, I live in a state where Amazon collects sales tax, and it hasn't really changed my behavior with respect to Amazon because of Amazon Prime, which is a bigger factor for me, and the convenience of the 2-day shipping rather than whether or not I have to pay a sales tax. My sense is that. This isn't necessarily the same for other online retailers. I think that Amazon might even prefer to have every state collect sales tax because it would actually maybe create more of a disadvantage for their other e-commerce competitors rather than for themselves. Amazon's so big that they can navigate all that stuff. And because they do collect in so many states, it might actually make them make some of their competitors, which may not be collecting sales tax, more less competitive with respect to them.
Is that your understanding as well, Matthew C. Klein?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the big competitors they have aren't really so much online only, but stores that are both online and brick and mortar that in many cases were already collecting sales tax. So, as at like the Targets and the Best Buys and Home Depots of the world, and to the extent that this has a change, it probably on the margin would. for Amazon. But on the other hand, since so many customers seem to have shifted to this Amazon marketplace vendors, and Amazon, the company, still gets paid as a consequence of that, I mean, I don't think the business model is going to be significantly reduced. And of course, Amazon Prime is very convenient, and Amazon itself, you know, generally has a broader selection of goods, and you know, they've invested a lot in their technology, and they often have cost savings, you know, even when you figure in the sales tax. But I think the interesting question, which is sort of hard to say, is, you know, in the 1990s, early 2000s, before Amazon had all of these nice features, would it have been as popular? And it's hard to say. I mean, you know, you look at sales tax in some places, we're talking about like 9% or more added cost for a lot of cities, especially for bigger purchases, net of the shipping. I mean, that can be significant. You know, maybe now you can think of it sort of like infant industry subsidy that's, you know, being taken away. And I think now that Amazon is probably fine with it, they've adapted. Now they just open distribution centers in every state so they can reduce their shipping times. And talking about same day delivery for certain products. But, you know, would that have necessarily worked out the same way back in 1997? I don't know. You know, one study that was done at the time by, I think it came out in 99, by Austin Goolsbee, who was the former chief economist in the Obama administration. And he calculated, based on some survey data, that if online retailers had to collect sales tax, that people would cut their internet shopping about a quarter, which is pretty extreme. And, you know, none of the more recent studies support that. But, of course, you know, the experience of buying things online has improved a lot since then. So that's probably, you know, a big factor. People trust the online payment system a lot better. Experience of being able to find things and compare prices a lot better now. So
also shipping, you know, for online commerce has gotten a lot faster. You know, Amazon,
right. And, you know, have improved their supply chains. Right. So, I mean, it's a really interesting question to think about how things might have unfolded differently.
Yeah. Well, I'm probably in the minority, but going forward, I think that any sort of packages delivered by drone should be tax-free, tax-exempt. But that's just me. Matthew C. Klein, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today.
Thank you, Aaron.
You can find Matthew C. Klein at BloombergView.com and on Twitter at M_C_Klein with a K. Well, Netflix officially slammed Comcast's proposed $45 billion acquisition of Time Warner Cable yesterday. Netflix CEO Reed Hastings said in a letter to shareholders that the deal would be anti-competitive and allow the combined company to charge arbitrary fees, which would be unfair to customers. Comcast Senior Vice President Jennifer Corey slammed back by calling the claims inaccurate and saying that Netflix is motivated by making money rather than helping consumers. Peter Rojas, this is an interesting war. These companies kind of rely on each other, and especially Netflix relies on Comcast to deliver the internet. And I guess that's the point, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Netflix is a huge percentage of internet traffic, especially in the evening hours here in the U.S. And I think if you went back, say, 15 years, you would not have expected one company to have to so dominate so much of the traffic. And because Netflix is delivering video, which is a high bandwidth product, it uses maybe a disproportionate amount of internet traffic. And I think that, you know, on some level, I think that there is a legitimate concern around peering agreements and around the fact that, you know, when you go back 15, 20 years at the start of the web, you know, the peering agreements basically evened out, you know, the amount of traffic that was being sent around. And now with one company delivering so much, maybe those peering agreements, I mean, the peering stuff is very complicated to untangle and more. We could talk about that for an hour. That said, it's very hard to sympathize with Comcast and Time Warner Cable. They have shown that when they have monopoly power in markets, they abuse it. And I think that they have spent a tremendous amount of money on lobbying to try to minimize the amount of regulation that they have to endure while you know, trying to have it both ways. They want to be monopolies in their markets, and they want to have a minimal amount of regulation. And I think that you have to kind of pick one, right? You can be a monopoly, and there's an argument that in some respects there's a natural monopoly that emerges here because of the last mile issue, et cetera, et cetera. But if that's the case, then you have to be deal with the regulation that comes along with that. I mean, that's how these things have always worked with utilities and other sort of comparable businesses. I essentially have one choice for internet service, you know, in my home, which is Time Warner Cable, and they arbitrarily raise the price and degrade the service, and I have no other option. And again, I can sort of maybe understand that the complications of having multiple pipes coming into my apartment, but you know, there should be some level of regulation here, and I think that to allow these two companies to combine is not in the public interest. And I think that you know, Netflix, first of all, the fact that Netflix would be opposed to the deal makes perfect sense. But I think that in some respects they're a proxy for the users of their service who, you know, if you go back historically, I don't think that, you know, the Comcast and Time Warner Cables of the world would even want to have, if they could have banned Netflix, you know, 10 or 15, 10 years ago when they started, or whenever they started their streaming service, they would have, right? They didn't want the competition.
Right. It's all very Game of Thrones. I mean, ultimately, you know, it's very easy and it's accurate to talk about the public interest. In fact, something like 50 public interest groups have publicly opposed the merger. But ultimately, the more powerful any of these companies come, the more of a stranglehold or the greater number of actual last mile connections that Comcast controls, the harder they're going to be to negotiate with for Netflix and for everybody, because they're really going to be calling the shots. They'll have something like 50% of the last mile connections. And that's a very, very powerful position, because everything else, all these companies that they call competitors, which include Google and everybody else, Apple, Facebook, you name it, they're calling them all competitors, will be dependent heavily on Comcast/Time Warner Cable. In fact, they're probably already too powerful. And despite this public opposition, despite industry opposition, you know, people tend to there's a consensus that the Justice Department is probably not going to oppose this merger. It's probably going to happen, despite everything. So I think that's it's going to be an interesting and new world once this merger goes through.
Yeah. What bothers me is that Comcast is already a massive company with massively profitable. And I think combining these two, the amount of power that they're going to have in Washington in terms of their lobbying and their ability to make, you know, contributions, you know, to legislators that are overseeing their regulation. I mean, I think that we're going to be in a situation where once this goes through, it's going to be very, very difficult to restrain the combined company and to keep them from raising prices and lowering quality of service. And I think with the fact that the FCC has been so toothless in driving real innovation at the home broadband level, you know, if there was some sort of plan to create competition, fine. I would actually be totally fine with this happening if I thought that they would have real competition in the market. But without that, I don't really see a compelling reason to let them create a company which would, you know, would ultimately be so damaging to consumers.
That's a good point. Well, we've been talking a lot about TV and court cases and all that kind of stuff, and you spent a huge chunk of your career writing about gadgets, so we have a really interesting gadget to talk about here today. Lytro unveiled a new prosumer camera today called the Lytro Ilium. Lytro, if you recall, is famous for making those weird-looking cameras that let you focus the pictures after you've taken them. Well, the new camera isn't so weird-looking, and at $1,599, it's not cheap either. So with us to tell us about this brand new gadget is Ed Begg, tech columnist for USA Today. Welcome, Ed Begg.
Nice to be with you.
So how does the Lytro Ilium compare with the original Lytro camera?
Well, they're really, I mean, it's apples and oranges here. I mean, we're talking about a camera that was $399 or $499. The original, it kind of looked like an oversized box or oversized lipstick tube is how I described it, versus something that is a real camera. It looks like, you know, something like a DSLR, has a lot more capability than the original camera. I mean, the original was interesting because of what you mentioned, this idea that you could take a picture and not worry about it too much and then focus after the fact. That was novel. A lot of us wrote about it, thought it was really cool. But the camera itself was, you know, a version 1.0. And I don't mean that in any sense positively. Do you know anybody who actually bought one of these things? I never bought one.
Nope.
But it was intriguing. Nope. We were all intrigued by it. And the new one, again, is a real camera. It has things that, basic things that weren't there the first time around, like a memory card slot, you know, a removable battery, a real camera lens. I mean, there's a big sort of the equivalent of a 30 to a 250 millimeter lens here. So it's a real camera.
And it also has a few things that regular cameras don't have, like GPS and Wi-Fi support, right?
Correct. Correct. And, you know, we shouldn't underestimate that, especially in DSLRs. I mean, you don't see a lot of that, you know, in that category of camera. What I want to see is kind of something in between, you know, something that becomes more mainstream ultimately. It's not going to be mainstream at $1,600, certainly.
Yeah. So do you think the Focus Later feature is a gimmick, or is this something that people, you know, the mainstream users might actually enjoy?
Well, it's an enjoyable feature. Is it a feature by itself that's going to make you go out and buy a camera? I don't think so. We're actually starting to see a lot of this show up in smartphones. You know, sure. It may not work quite as well as the Lytro does, but it works well enough where it's a nice party trick. You know, we've seen it, for example, on the new HTC One phone has it. Some other phones have something similar. Again, it's cool, but is it cool enough to get you to, you know, spend your money on a camera like this? I don't think so.
Now, Peter Rojas, this is actually a really interesting gadget unto itself. For example, it has a quad-core Qualcomm Snapdragon processor, the same one that's in the Galaxy S5.
Yeah.
So this is 2,000 times more powerful than the original Lytro camera. It's kind of a cool device.
Yeah, I mean, it's I'm kind of, you know, from a geek standpoint, it's really interesting, and I find it kind of compelling that they have taken this technology and actually put it into more of a traditional camera form factor. I mean, it reminds me a lot of the Sony cameras in terms of the way it looks. I think this was probably what they needed to do. I don't think that the first one sold very well, and I certainly have seen it discounted in a bunch of places. But I think, like Ed says, I mean, it's not clear to me that this is a big selling point for, well, it's certainly not going to be a selling point to the average person, because most people don't do a lot of work on the photos that they take beyond maybe applying a filter or something like that and then uploading it to Instagram. I think that if they can demonstrate to professionals that there is a real big advantage to this, and it's not something that that they can just do sort of in post-production or whatever. I mean, I'm not saying that you can do all this stuff in post-production, but that it provides enough of a benefit over what you can do when you're just editing the photo later on your computer. Maybe there'll be a business here, but this definitely feels like the kind of thing that when they can get the price down below $1,000 or ideally closer to say $600 or $700, then all of a sudden it's not such a big deal to pick one up. But for $1,600, that's a lot. I guess there's a discount if you pre-order, but that's a lot of money to spend. And I think that most people that are spending in that range for a camera are buying, digital SLRs and kind of know what they're working with already.
Yeah. Now, Ed Begg, now it seems to me that if they could somehow bring the price down to probably under $700, and if also the optics and the quality of the photographs that this thing could produce were, you know, up there with the Canons type cameras, this could be a real contender. But unless those factors are present, I don't see this really happening. Now, there are two basic uses for this, as I understand it. One of them is to take pictures and then focus it later as a part of the editing process, and then you end up with a shallow depth of field picture that has some really carefully constructed focus and out of focus. The other one is to upload and post an interactive photo that the viewer can refocus. Is that your understanding as well? And where do you think the actual users will end up gravitating for this
kind of thing? Excuse me. That's actually what makes this very interesting is just that. You know, I may not be the guy who goes out and spends $1,600, or even if the price does come down under $1,000 to whatever level we agree on is a good level. It's still not going to be, you know, it's not going to be your point and shoot camera, but maybe professionals use this and we, you know, I could even see advertisers possibly using this. I mean, you know, you can think very broadly here. I think the technology is probably here to stay. It's still in its primitive stages. You know, the folks behind Lytro will tell you that the future of photography is in this so-called light field technology. I don't know about that, but I do think the technology is interesting enough that it's not going to go away. And maybe it is just in us being viewers. That may be the future for this.
Yeah, interesting point. Well, Ed Begg, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News Today.
Sure thing.
All right, you can find Ed Begg's work on usatoday.com, of course, and on Twitter at Ed Begg. Let me spell that, E-D-B-A-I-G. Well, one quick note that came in late this morning. AT&T tends to launch an online TV service this year. The company, along with their partner, the Chernin Group, plans to invest more than $500 million in the venture. Now, Peter Rojas, does everybody have to be a TV company? What's the deal with this? Even AT&T is getting into the racket.
Well, I can certainly see why they would want to do this. I mean, they're, again, looking at what Netflix is doing and how successful it's been. And I think that the idea that what we sort of call over-the-top programming is going to be a bigger part of people's television habits makes a lot of sense. And obviously, Peter Chernin has a lot of experience in Hollywood and the programming side of things. So it makes sense that they would combine together. And I think that... you know, it has been interesting that there hasn't been besides Hulu, which is really focused on TV, there hasn't been someone that has really tried to take on Netflix really head on. And I think part of it is that it costs a lot of money. We know how much Netflix has to spend in terms of getting licenses for content. And now they're spending more money now to create original content and programming like House of Cards. So I think that if these guys are determined to, spend the money, acquire the licensing and create compelling, interesting original programming, they might have a shot at this. You can just see the challenges that Amazon has had with its Netflix competitor, which I think has a fraction of the viewing time that Netflix has. But it makes sense that that people would want to get into this business because I think it's only going to be a growing market.
Yeah, well, my prediction is that AT&T is going to do what you said. They're going to come out with the original programming, House of Sim Cards. I don't know.
House of Sim Cards.
We'll see. Well, Peter Rojas, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News Today.
Thank you.
Now, where can people find your blogging work and other writing work?
ROJ.AS is my personal site. It's actually a Squarespace site.
Yay.
So I moved my blog over there about a year ago or so.
Great. Wonderful. Well, thanks again for being on Tech News Today. I always appreciate you coming on. I hope to have you back again soon. All right. We want you to subscribe to Tech News Today. It's a great idea. You can subscribe to the audio version or the video version. Just go to twit.tv/TNT. And we want to hear from you. If you have any opinions about any of the stories we covered today, send us an email at tnt@twit.tv or leave us a voicemail by calling 260-TNT-SHOW. And don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight with Sarah Lane at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every weeknight. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.